Okay, well, based on that last talk, lesson left, you guys can learn from optical interferometry, I would say. I mean, when Shep came to Michigan, I don't know, when was that, Shep, 5 years ago or so, talking about some early SAG A-star EHT results, I know that you were still showing images using clean, and I know we had a nice chat about how we could, how our algorithms that we've been doing at the char array and with optical interferometry, you know, with relatively easy, you know, translation of some of the data products, we could try some experiments. So it's neat to see in just those 5 years how many people have joined in on this effort. And just to give sort of just a quick view of from the optical interferometry perspective, and that there may be some still ways we can partner together on this, on, because we have some of the same challenges from the imaging point of view. I wanted to just also mention that this is these slides or these presentations is effort by me, and Fabien Baron, and Roussan Liu, who did some led some simulations we did with some of, you know, the OI algorithms with some simulated data that I'll show. And just to give you a reason why there's such a clear connection between them, if you look at this image up here, which is some reconstructed images of the M87 system, you can see, you can compare it to some of the tests that we did in 2004, when in our field we started to do beauty contests, where we would set up blind tests based on realistic data, and then have various groups try to reconstruct it, you know, completely blind of what the real data or what the real image was, and then we would meet at a conference every 2 years at the SPIE, and then it would be revealed who won the contest and matched the images best. And so we've been doing this for 10 years, and it's been extremely productive to the field. And you can see that an image of a young stellar object has a lot of the same problems. You know, the resolution that we have at CHARA is very similar structurally to the black hole systems. We have a system that has pretty much a dark field around it. It's not a crowded field, but you only have maybe a few, or you know, five or six times your object is only a few times bigger than your resolution. And so you really need to extract as much information as possible to do that. So in this case, of course, this is a star, and this is a heated up rim of dust surrounding the star in a different accretion disk. Okay, so just a quick background for people. You probably know that the real workhorse image reconstruction for radio and millimeter interferometry has been clean with self-calibration, for instance. And this method mainly operates on the complex visibilities directly. The closure phases can get used through self-calibration techniques, but in the modern day with the more sensitive receivers and with fast switching and phase referencing, most arrays don't need to actually use, like VLA and ALMA, don't need to use those methods. They basically do just work directly on the visibilities and then do some cleanup with the with closure phases. Now, when you have, that works if you're not pushing the boundaries too much. Now, with optical interferometry and also with the EHT, you have relatively poor UV coverage. I mean, this is the best case UV coverage that you can get with the CHARA array with 6 fixed telescopes. And here, you know, you compare it to the VLA. And further, in the optical, we don't actually measure, you probably know, complex visibilities. We measure, literally, we don't even measure that. We measure, you know, squared fluxes or squared electric fields, right? We don't measure electric fields. And we also have to average the closure phase through the quantity of the bispectrum. So in no way can we use sort of data products like the UV fits and the complex electric fields that are used in the radio, that come out of the radio correlators, for instance. And so we have different observables, and our field had to create our own data formats because the UV fits formats and the VLBA formats were not, you know, did not have the observables that we actually measure. I mean, there was a generation where people would sort of try to backfill it and fake it, and that made some progress, but you couldn't maintain the errors and the correlations in your quantities, things like that. And in our field, too, there was really no hardware solution to allow phase referencing or better signal-to-noise that would let you just sort of grow out of this problem. We're looking at a funding situation where we're not going to have 30 telescopes anytime soon, and we're not going to have fundamentally improved signal-to-noise or better atmosphere or even longer baseline. So we're at a field where we really put a lot of effort into the image reconstruction. And I only show this just to highlight it for people who are new to this. That when you do, the way clean works is it is really a true inversion process where you take your data in some kind of a UV plane, you do a Fourier transform, and you get this some messy looking system that's dominated by artifacts. I think visually you can see this probably was a binary star, and because you can see these artifacts, this ring, for instance, copied around that other source. And so this led to the idea that you can treat this image processing as a deconvolution in this image plane. So you actually do this, you know, this inverse Fourier transform, get your image, and then you try to clean it up using deconvolution. So indeed, you know from the Fourier coverage what your deconvolving function is, your PSF. And so when you take your dirty map and you want to take this into account, you can use the clean method or other deconvolution methods to sort of turn this into a beautiful two-point sources here. Now, the limitations of clean is that, again, I mentioned already you need to have complex visibilities, but another issue is that the error bars, what if they're very different across your UV plane? How does that get propagated in the image plane, and how do you weight those in the most optimal way? Worse is that you may have a lot of data points in one part of the UV plane, let's say short baselines, and then you may only have a few at the long baseline. So how do you weight those? You may care about the long baselines, and there's a whole, you know, rigmarole of how you weight your UV plane, and there's a method to deal with that in clean, but it's not optimal. It's a very sort of by the seat of your pants method to do it. You can kind of weight the long baselines more, or you can kind of uniform your signal to noise in the UV plane, but it's certainly not the optimal way to do it. This leads to less resolution, right? If you have an image and you're taking an average of all your points, your resolution you're going to have through a standard deconvolution will be related to your average baseline. And so if you want better resolution, you have to weight your long baselines. If you want really good image fidelity, you weight it more uniformly. So there's a whole trade-off you make. But in reality, you shouldn't have to make those trade-offs if you fit directly to the data. And so you super resolution, the so-called ability to see believable structures that are less than lambda over D, and this is what we kind of mean by super resolution, that is much more limited with clean. And then again, in optical interferometry and with the EHT, you can't really spare to lose that leverage. You know, in a normal world, you don't really care. You want good image fidelity, you want no ambiguity, you just lose that factor two of resolution, but you have a solid result and you don't have to worry about it, but you do have that problem. So what we're doing is we started with more modern computing, you know, that you have in the 2000s or even in the 90s. You want to solve this problem is really just from a more standard inversion theory, where you just want to do hypothesis testing, where you want to ideally say you have an image and it's really just a model, right, with a bunch of free parameters. The problem is you have more free parameters than you have, say, data constraints, and there's degeneracies, you know, given your limited and noisy data. And so this is what, you know, you call this ill-posed inversion problem, because there's not a unique inversion, there's not a unique solution to that inversion process. And so just by the sort of heuristic way to think about it is, you have an infinite number of images that you might compare to the data and give you a chi-square that's acceptable, right? That's a chi-square of around 1, but you need to choose the one that's the best, the one that you want to present. And this is where you can use other information. And this, the generic way is you basically think of, you need to come up with some kind of a tiebreaker criteria. All those images that are statistically consistent with your your data, you need to find the ones that you prefer. And this comes through this whole thing called regularization, which then, if it's the right kind of regularizer, can give you a unique or a class of solutions that can be inverted. And so this is just for those looking from YouTube. You can look at the math behind it, but this is not a math-oriented talk. But the probability of an image that you have based on your data and your image formation process, M, can be rewritten by Bayes' theorem to be based on the one you're used to, the likelihood of your data given your hypothesis, given your model image. That's just a standard chi-squared. But then you need to fold that against other probabilities. This is, what is the probability of this image kind of based on everything else you know, right? If you know that there's nothing else around it because maybe you have some other information, then you can put this into this probability here. Right? Or if you know how it looks in a nearby wavelength and you want to leverage that, and you think it's not going to look so different from this longer wavelength image, you could put that in here. Or if you looked at it yesterday and you think it didn't change, you can put that in here. So this is a very flexible paradigm where you can put all that information as a probability into this. And of course, you take the log of it, and you're doing a maximization of this sum. There's a chi-squared term, and then there's regularizer terms that you throw in there. And it's just now becomes a computer problem of how you do it. There's different regularizers that are common. Again, we didn't talk about it here. It's not super important. But you know, there's the maximum entropy, which is a very common, one of the original ones in the 80s that was quite successful. And there's some Berg entropy, which is similar. This is where you just take you take an image and you just sum up, in this case, the value of the pixel times the log of the value of the pixel, basically, and you just integrate over your whole image, and that's called your entropy. And you can maximize that. There's the so-called L2 norm, which is quite common. It's often called the Tinkenov regularizer, where you want to operate on the square of the pixel value. So that would prefer, say a uniform field over peaky fields. Or you can do it the other way around. If you'd rather have a bunch of point sources rather than a uniform field, you can change what you're using as your regularizer. Again, you can bring some physics to it. If you're looking at a bunch of point sources, like a star cluster, you would use a different regularizer than if you think it's an accretion disk that's very smooth. It just makes some sense. Another really nice one is total variation, which operates on the gradient of your image. So you might like something to have a minute. You don't want there to be very much variation. So for instance, if you have a star, like I image stars, you'd want it to be very black, have sort of a discontinuity in the gradient, right, where it just goes up to some value, and then you may have a star again that's uniform. And that would have the minimal in the total variation, because you put all the variation in a gradient, not in the actual image itself. So these are just give you a flavor that there's a whole lot of stuff you can do in this field. They can be sort of motivated very heuristically. They don't need to have a strong mathematical formalism to them to actually be useful. Okay, so really quick, as you might expect, there's two major methods to do this that have come out in the field. There's a gradient descent basic method, which is very fast, requires, the gradients to be able to be calculated of your criteria. And then there is more of a Markov chain type methods where you just, for instance, the one that I use a lot, you basically divide your image into, say, 1,000 or 10,000 equal pieces. Each of those pieces just can move around in the grid, and they move, and you look to see whether you improved your criteria or not, and you decide to either stick to the move or stay where you were based on that result. And you just do that, millions of times to see what happens. And so these have these names like BSMEM for the bispectrum maximum entropy method, and MIRA is another one that does this. And then MACM and SQUEEZE is one of the Markov chain-based ones. And again, these all do, I should emphasize, these are what we call these forward transform methods. You don't ever do an inverse Fourier transform. You always just take your image, do your Fourier transform, calculate your observables, whether they be polarization data, or you could put SEDs in there. You can put anything into your data, right? It doesn't have to even be just polarization data or interferometry data, right? This is what's great about the forward transform. You just take whatever you want and just push it into your data space and then compare it and get your chi-squared. You don't have to go backwards and invert it. It's just slower, in principle, but you can do it these days. And just to mention a few buzzwords you might hear, regularization and compressed sensing and sparsity, and these are kind of what people talk about in the literature. The idea of sparsity or compressed sensing is where you kind of take this to an extreme, and what you do is you want to find a basis set of your object where there most of the coefficients will be zero. So like if you're imaging a bunch of point sources, then your dictionary that you might want to use are a bunch of point sources, like pixels in a grid, for instance. But if you're doing something with structure, you may do wavelet coefficients, like you do in like the JPEG compression, where you try to put your information into wavelet space rather than in pixel space. And your idea is you want to come up with the efficient basis where you can it's maximizing entropy or minimizing your degrees of freedom, right? If I can explain your image with only four numbers, then that's better than one that required 300 numbers. And part of that is being clever with what basis you use, right? So it's a difficult process to fully optimize, but this is what people talk about with sparsity, trying to find that basis set and minimizing on different basis sets and trying to find the best one. So I'm not going to say much about it again. It's on the video. You can look at that. But it's just another version of a regularizer that you can define mathematically. Okay. So if you do this, I just want to show, I showed you the example of clean. If you do this with maximum entropy, again, it's a forward transfer method. So rather than starting with something ugly and making it look clean, you don't clean it. You start with something simple like a point source, if you'll see here, and then it just iterates. In this case is just by gradient descent method towards the best fit, and you're left with it. And then you just get your answer. And again, depending on how fast it is. And indeed, this shows that you get the full resolution of your system based on how much signal to noise you have, and in here you have, in this with the maximum entropy constraint, you generally get about 1/3 of your lambda over d resolution in common practice. Now with long baseline interferometry, we don't have perfect UV coverage, just like with EHT. We started to use these methods even when we only had four telescopes. So, you know, in 2006, we only had four telescopes, and so at CHARA working at one time, and so trying to image with four telescopes is very difficult, and we really had to constrain, use our priors as much as we could. So these are the kind of UV coverages we had with four telescopes, but for very simple objects like rapidly rotating stars, you know, we were able to do a nice job imaging actually stars other than the sun for the first time, the main sequence stars for the first time, seeing that they're elongated from centrifugal force and seeing gravity darkening effects. And so even though these are pretty simple objects, we could do that with four telescopes. With six telescopes, we were able to do more, we have much better coverage, and we were able to do more complicated things. This was a very remarkable event of a dark, cold dust disk eclipsing a giant star. And so you can actually see this finger of black blocking half the hemisphere of this star. And if you have any doubts, we actually could make a movie of this where you actually see this finger moving across the star. And that's what you can do with just six telescopes. So this is really exciting. And you know, just like with EHT, you know, you can start to do things like image below the resolution. Lambda over D is this arrow here. This is lambda over D, or longest baseline. But for this interacting binary system, Beta Lyrae, you know, that's sufficient to make a movie of that accretion disk and the Roche lobe filling primary in that system. So we definitely know that things like EHT, of course, even when you marginally resolve things, can do a lot of science. And certainly, we all believe that EHT can do this. But we can actually do it with real data there, not just in simulation. And so the last few minutes, just to show the results of the first time that, you know, Ruzan, Lu, and us worked together on the using simulated data from the EHT. This came out this year in 2014. It addressed a number of issues, so I'll just zip through it. I'm sure you've all read it carefully by now in preparation for the conference. We have that the study addressed a number of things. And so here's the UV coverage that was used. So if this is called so-called realistic UV coverage, but as far as I can tell, it's as good as it will ever get. But it's at least not totally made up. It's based on real stations. And signal to noise as well. This is based on thermal noise, not based on any limitations of the atmosphere. So it's, again, kind of the best case you can get, but it's realistic in the sense that it's based on real receivers and real potential bandwidths that we hope to get. Just to see, this is the signal to noise. You can kind of get a flavor for it. So the main point is this is a comparison of different methods. And so this paper tried to compare the different methods in a quantitative way. And as part of this beauty contest in our field, you know, we have had to deal with how do we define what's a better image, right, in some objective way, and it's actually not so easy to do. Different metrics can benefit certain algorithms sort of subconsciously, right, by the way they're defined. So, I wanted to point out that you can see that here they all do a pretty good job. I mean, clean is not doing so good, but you see that these different methods reveal this shadow of the black hole with the jet there. But but when you start to have more signal-to-noise issues, like at 345 gigahertz, you definitely see that some of the methods start to be better than others. So for instance, this Markov chain method was able to, it kept the flux tight. It was able to use priors to keep the flux closer in and not let it kind of spread out in the lower signal-to-noise limit. So again, this is where the prior, able to control your priors helps you. And anyway, there's different metrics. This is like a least squared error type of metric, which is the most obvious one. But this shows you that that metric can fail, that you can have a range of images that all have the same metric, but actually, visually, we would obviously prefer this one over these, and based on just our own way we do our own mental image processing. So there's other methods, like the structural similarity metric, which unfortunately has some extra free parameters that you have to tune, but it can, for instance, do a better job in some cases if you tune it right. But this also reveals that there's no objective answer. You kind of have to study your particular problem. If you're studying black holes, you want to, you know, look at realistic simulations of black holes and tune your metric to those, which makes it a little, obviously, less model independent than you would like. But if you, you know, but for science, you often have to sacrifice model independence and push your theory that you're testing. So I'll just say that anyway, there's a particular method that currently is winning this beauty contest, although this was not blind, and so you have to take it with a grain of salt. But in the future, we should do that. And anyway, then of course, once you have a good realistic setup, you can test lots of things like dropping stations, changing bandwidth, where should you put your resources, right, to do your science. So just last, you've heard about changes in time and changing with polarization. So just to say, these are things that we have started to do in optical interferometry, but not as much as we needed in EHT. In interferometry, optical interferometry, we actually spend more time with spectral lines, like spectral features that you don't seem to have in your system. But we do the same tricks with spectral features like you might do with polarization, using one as a reference. Like you just heard how you can use the polarized, use your average centroid as a reference against your polarized centroid. Well, you can do the same thing with the spectral line. If you have an emission line, you can use the continuum as a reference. So you have some of these same tricks you can pull. So in conclusion, I hope it's clear that the EHT has some very similar imagery construction challenges as optical interferometry, and that indeed super resolution below about half a, you know, 1/3 or so lambda over b is, you know, quite achievable with these algorithms, and that the key black hole features like the shadow of the black hole, you know, can be pulled out from these, from simulated data with realistic noise, and that I would say I think that you can see there's a lot of independent work going on the imagery construction, and I hope that the EHT consortium can help organize people to work kind of coherently on this. And you know, we need to have data products. Like, you know, I'm sure Michael has some polarization data products that's probably just some built, you know, homemade data format. Like, how would I test it with my code? You know, we need to have data formats to make us so we can exchange data. We need to generate some more synthetic data. Like I just showed you M87, but what we need to do that for, of course, SAGE star and a range of models. We of course want to try, we should try to think of how we separate black hole parameters. I mean, Avery mentioned this earlier, but how do we separate things like the black hole spin and mass from just like the accretion disk part, right? Like we want to, you know, if we can get the mass and spin very well, but we don't know the MHD, that's, you know, that's okay, right? But we'll, you know, we should separate them and not be, try to not be, limit ourselves. And lastly, I mean, I think we definitely should organize some kind of beauty contest to establish credibility and to facilitate all the standardization that, you know, we should do. So that's it. I will just end there. Thank you.
All right, so we need to arrange for something to be overflowing its Roche lobe onto Sajid. Sorry, that was a hell of a movie. So we're trading questions for coffee time now. So let's get a couple in. Elliot, maybe? Oh, Avery, go ahead.
Sorry, Elliot. I got the mic. This is really interesting because the way that I see this field is that it bridges the gap between forward modeling based purely on theory and completely agnostic reconstruction. That there's an opportunity to put in some amount of information that you think should be there. Some things are absolutely not controversial, like positivity of the flux and things like that. One thing that I wonder about, and I have to say I don't have any answers, and we come at it from the theory side, the pure theory side all the time, is some version of quality assurance. So if I have some admixture of inputting theory by saying I'm looking at a stellar field so I should be seeing stars, or I'm looking at something with a shadow so I want to be able to see shadows, how do I quality assure that the analysis is not going to introduce an artifact? Do I do it with beauty contests? And if I do it with beauty contests, how do I make sure that I have a sufficient variety of things so that I don't always see what I want?
Well, it's a combination of beauty contests for the most model independent version, and then you also can use more detailed thinking like Michael talked about, where you're looking at particular signatures and how that can be linked very strongly to particular qualitative features. Like that combination is, I think, what you want. Like if you see a bounce, like for instance in my field, if you see a bounce in the visibility curve, you know there's something like a ring, right? If you see a Gaussian, then there's no ring. And in my field, we're trying to figure out if there's emission coming from inside the dust destruction radius of a star. So like we can't image that yet, but if we see a bounce, we at least know there's a ring. If we see no bounce, which is at the moment, we're not seeing any bounce, which is very surprising. It means there's something in there, it shouldn't be there. And so that's the kind of combination of, we do the beauty contest, but you also have to use, you have to be clever to be decisive, not just be like, trust us, this image is what it is. You know, you need to have a few things that you can really explain in three slides that will convince you based on a closure phase or a polarization behavior that someone who pays attention can get. So I think it's that combination.
Is there a rule of thumb signal to noise needed to get to the super resolution of a third lambda over d? Meaning how high do you actually need signal to noise, or?
You know, signal to noise is hard to say in one word what that is, but you know, in my experience, you know, if you can track the fringes and detect things, then you have enough signal to noise. Now, in the EHT, I think that's probably the same, because you have to see something within your coherence time, or you can't average forever, like with phase referencing. So basically, if you can see enough baselines on the short time, then the averaging process, if you take it, you know, so you have it's the ratio of the total time to your 12 seconds. So if you're limited by your 12 seconds, if you can see it on 12 seconds, and when you take a day of data, you're going to have enough signal to noise. That's the way I think about it in my field. So you're never in the signal to noise star, because if you are, you are not getting any data. So if you're getting data, you kind of get yourself up to a plateau of signal to noise. Now, in detail, of course, when long baselines, there's limitations, but the crudest answer is, if you can see closing baselines between everything and 12 seconds, you're okay. I don't know if anyone agrees with that in radio, but that would be my optical answer.
Take a last question.
So John, given the statement about non-uniqueness of images, do you ever construct ensembles of solutions and assign a probability to them and say, you know, these are the 100 images that have a probability greater than 1% of fitting the data?
You know, we had dreams of doing that, because with the Markov chain, you can access all sorts of those kind of things, right? You can make a movie of a whole bunch of images, and you know, someone could look at this movie and kind of see this range of images. But in my field, in optical interferometry, we still have pretty strong systematics in the calibration of visibilities. And when you don't have much UV coverage, you know, if you have one visibility that's 20% too high, that will show up as junk in your image. And so we actually are more dominated by that right now. So like in theory, yeah. So I don't know if I'm not sure how the, you know, when we do this, these simulations that we've done are all perfectly calibrated. Like there's no systematics in the amplitude calibration. So it'd be interesting if we start putting in like significant calibrations, whether you're going to start getting like things that look like jets flying off and things like this in the reconstruction. So that needs to be done.
All right. With that crash, we'll cut it off here.